Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we just discussed the mass incarceration documentary 13 with Van Jones, and now we'll look at another Oscar-nominated documentary that also delves into our country's often racialized justice system. That was O.J. Made in America, the five-part, eight-hour documentary that was part of ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary series and provides an in-depth, nuanced look at the life and criminal trial of former sports hero and former American icon, O.J. Simpson. Joining me now is the director of the documentary, filmmaker Ezra Edelman. He's produced other noteworthy sports documentaries that you may know, such as Magic and Bird, A Courtship of Rivals, The Curious Case of Curt Flood, and the Emmy Award-winning Brooklyn Dodgers, Ghosts of Flatbush. Ezra, so nice of you to come in. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
And, you know, I think that most people believe they already knew everything about the O.J. Simpson story and murder trial that they cared to know. So how did you even convince ESPN to allow you to produce an eight-hour, five-part series?
Well, it's kind of the opposite. They had to convince me.
Really?
Yeah, because I think I had the same feeling as everyone who would come to potentially watching the film. You know, the same idea. What more is there to say? And that was my initial instinct. But they were offering me this huge canvas. It wasn't an eight-hour canvas, but it was in the 4 to 5 hour range. And I thought that whereas I'm not as interested or engrossed by the murder and the trial, offering me that canvas allows me to explore issues that I am interested in, which is I knew this was a story about race in America. I knew this was a story about celebrity in America. I knew this was a story about the city of Los Angeles and policing and the criminal justice system. If you're giving me the time, then I can go back and really delve into the historical context that helped explain what happened during the trial in 95.
And just the very title of the series, O.J. Made in America, suggests to people who don't already know what they're getting into with this film that this is not just an individual story. This is a story of America.
That's exactly right. I mean, it is a story of America between who O.J. is and was as an icon in terms of how he was created, you know, in our landscape as a football star. And, you know, from the time he came to be famous in 1967, 68, he came up in the most substantial of times when not only he arrives at USC, this white enclave, apolitical conservative, but it was right next door to Watts, which just a year and a half earlier had experienced this explosion in violence with the riots. And at the same time that happened, that sort of juxtaposition of O.J. at this school full of privilege, and he made the choice that he was going to become, you know, he was not going to align himself with the movement of the time, which at that point embodied in Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Russell, all of these black athletes were being increasingly outspoken about the world that they lived in, about the racism that they were experiencing. And O.J. said, I don't want to be a part of that. So for me, it was, we can explore sort of the choices that O.J. made as a man and using this as a lens to talk about race, identity, masculinity, celebrity, all of these things.
And one of the aspects of your film that I found particularly compelling is that O.J. believed he was able to transcend his race because of his talent on the football field. So here's a one-minute clip where African-American sociologist Harry Edwards, who as a student at Berkeley, approached O.J. Simpson about standing in solidarity with other black athletes like Muhammad Ali and fellow football player Jim Brown and boycotting the 1968 Olympics to protest the treatment of blacks in America. This clip has Harry Edwards in it and O.J. discussing the boycott when he was a student at USC. Harry Edwards speaks first.
O.J. was approached because he was the biggest name in collegiate athletics at that time. He was also a world record holding track star.
That's O.J. Simpson.
So here we got two for one. When I asked him, I said, we're trying to get black athletes to understand they have a role in the current civil rights movement. His response was, I'm not black, I'm O.J.
What they think is right, I guess they must follow their beliefs. Well, right now I don't want to be involved in it because I'm not in track. You know, I'm running track, but when it comes to Olympic time, I'll be in football, so I have no comment on the matter.
O.J. was saying,
I want to be judged not by the color of my skin. I want to be judged by the content of my character and, most of all, the caliber of my competence. I think I'm the greatest football player that this country has ever seen. That's all I want to be judged by. Don't tell me I've got to do this because I'm black.
And to reinforce the point, here's another clip from the film. After O.J. became a sports superstar, white Americans began to validate his perspective that he could transcend his blackness. So here's another clip from the film that showcases this, where former New York Times sports writer Robert Lipsight discusses a conversation that he had with O.J. Simpson early in his pro career.
He was telling me a story about being at a teammate's wedding with his wife, sitting at a table of mostly, as he said, Negroes. And he overheard a white woman at the next table saying, look, there's O.J. sitting with all those niggers. And I remember in my naivete saying to O.J., gee, wow, that must have been terrible for you. He said, no, it was great. Don't you understand? She knew. I wasn't black. She saw me as O.J.
And what's amazing about the story...
You cut out the last line.
Which is?
And right then, well, can I say the word?
Don't say the word.
Well, he says,
but make the point.
He says, and right then, I knew that O.J. was screwed. And yeah, that was an eye-opening moment for Robert Lipsight in 1969 when O.J. was a rookie with the Buffalo Bills. But it really sort of, like, the immediacy of that so quickly, and that Robert Lipsight so clearly remembers that moment, you know, some 45 to 50 years later, it speaks to sort of the delusion that O.J. was trafficking in and how much of an impression that made on him, on Robert.
And I'm sure it's chilling to people to hear the clip if they heard it just now for the first time and when they saw your film for the first time of O.J. way back then saying, well, I don't want to be involved in it because I'm not in track. Right. I'm not running track. When it comes to Olympic time, I'll be in football, so I have no comment on the matter.
I mean, it's, you know, and it's a very interesting thing because, like, look, there's a level to which, you know, personally, you know, I approach this subject in all ways, with trying to have as much empathy I could for all the subjects involved, O.J. included, which is one reason why we spend so much time sort of examining his rise to really understand why we also loved him in the first place. And when you hear that line that he says to Harry Edwards, I'm not black, I'm O.J., you know, I don't think O.J. wanted to be white, but O.J. certainly believed in his own exceptionalism, and he certainly believed that he didn't want to be held down because of his race. And, you know, it's interesting because I've thought a lot about what was I like when I was a 20 or 21-year-old kid in college. And the pressure that was put on him to align himself with this movement, I think, was incredibly great. So do I have some empathy with him saying, well, you know, I have my own ambitions, and maybe if I do this, that would hurt those ambitions. Is there anything wrong with that? Maybe I'm going to choose my own path, and if I am a commercial star or Hollywood star as a black man and create this paradigm on my own, maybe that does its own good. I don't necessarily think that was in his mind, especially when then you hear the next clip. And that's when you start to see so quickly how much he starts to believe in that exceptionalism and realize that, no, his mind's working on a different plane than most black people.
We'll continue after a little break. We'll play more clips from Ezra Edelman's film, O.J. Made in America, now nominated for Best Feature Documentary at the Oscars, and we may have time for a few phone calls. I see some people are calling in already with some questions and thoughts. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Ezra Edelman, director of the documentary O.J. Made in America, 8 hours as it aired in parts on ESPN and now nominated for Best Feature-Length Documentary at the Oscars. This is film number 2 in our Best Documentary series. If you're just joining us, we do this every year. We invite all 5 directors. It's usually 5 of those films nominated for Best Documentary. Let everybody else do the, you know, the Hollywood blockbusters. This is how geeky we are. We do the Best Documentary nominees. And Ezra Edelman made O.J., made in America. Let me cut through 2 more clips here, the other 2 that we have from the film, because it keeps telling the story that you were telling about O.J. Simpson and his relationship with race, and then by the end of his criminal saga, race's relationship with him. So as O.J. became a superstar, white Americans began to validate the perception of his own exceptionalism, as you were describing. And eventually O.J. Discusses in the 1970s how he viewed pressure put on him to get involved in social issues. He was even asked to run for office.
I've had a lot of pressure on me to go into politics. I was pulled into it once or twice in the black movement when I was in school. I think they tried to use this, and in many cases it hurt guys. I felt that with Harriet, it hurt Tommy Smith, it hurt John Carlos. Standing on his platform, I thought they should have been standing on their own platform. I said, if I stand on the platform, I'm going to be speaking for O.J.
All right, and one more clip where one of the jurors from the O.J. trial, Carrie Bess, discusses the impact of the racial tension between police and black Americans in L.A. on O.J. Simpson's trial.
Do you think that they're members of the jury that voted to acquit O.J. because of Rodney King?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
How many of you think felt that way?
Oh, probably 90% of them.
90%? Did you feel that way?
Yes.
That was payback.
Uh-huh.
So, not that that clip is news to anybody here in 2017, I don't think. But the irony of O.J. Simpson is that despite distancing himself from blackness throughout his life, his acquittal in that trial hinged on the perception that the LAPD was racist.
Very much so. I mean, that's one of the great ironies of the story and what makes the story worth examining 20-something-odd years later. I mean, you had a predominantly black jury in the city of Los Angeles who had lived through this era of incredible criminal injustice when it came to African Americans, an era where, racist policing in many forms in Los Angeles, and that was brought to bear in the trial. By the time O.J., a guy who had distanced himself from his race, arrives as a defendant in this highest of profile murder cases, he all of a sudden is this symbolic black man on trial. And people invested in him in ways that sort of belied how he had lived his life and who he was. And the idea that Carrie Bess, a longtime Angeleno, was there for 9 months, but in the end, she was more taken by this history of injustice than she was by whatever happened in the case. And she even famously says in the movie how uninterested she was in the story of the domestic abuse that Nicole suffered at the hands of O.J. And that just, and again, it's a really sad saga in that two wrongs don't make a right. But it just speaks to how grave this history was and how much it preyed upon the hearts and minds of everyone in that jury box, but of black people in not just the city of Los Angeles, but across the country.
There is a critique of the film along those lines too. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott, in reviewing the film, largely positively, but he says the film, which so persuasively treats law enforcement racism as a systemic problem, can't figure out how to treat violence against women with the same rigor or nuance. What do you say back to him?
I don't agree. I think we spent a lot of time speaking very intimately about the abuse that Nicole suffered at the hands of O.J. And, so that's what I have to say about that.
Did O.J. himself, do you have any reason to believe, evolve on the question of race and his place as a black man in America after the irony of the role that race played at his trial?
Evolved? I don't know. I mean, I've never spoken to OJ. I can't get inside his head. I mean, I think OJ knew exactly what he was doing and who, I think he knew who he was and what he was doing at every part of his life. And I think it speaks to, he knew the politics that were at play between hiring Johnny Cochran in the first place, having him subsume Robert Shapiro as the head lawyer in the trial. And when you see in the film that he, you know, after he is acquitted, and in many ways he's shut out of the white community that he had so sort of taken pains to embrace himself within, he goes back to the black community, the church leaders and everyone, to get the love that he so needed and craved. And so I think he understood very clearly the dynamics that were in play, you know, regardless of how he viewed himself.
Chanel on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC with Ezra Edelman. Hi, Chanel.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment really quickly that I think when you're a black person and you get up to this status, that it's often that you do tend to feel that you're separate from the community, that, you know, you're not going through police brutality anymore. You're not really feeling what an everyday black person, you know, is going through. And I think it's common to want to step aside because you know all of the, you know, negative things that comes along with being black. And I think it's strange in OJ's case, but also not strange at all. What's strange is like what you've been talking about the whole time is that the black community supported him. But that had to do with so many other things. Like yesterday I asked my mother, because I just watched the TV series, The People versus OJ, and do you still think OJ is not guilty after all of these years? I was a kid when this trial was happening. She said, I don't think he's guilty, and I never thought he was guilty. So you still have, you know, this this whole generation of black people that still believe, you know, that he's not guilty. But even though he was so separated from black culture, that's just what happens, I think, when you have money. And, you know, and Lil Wayne said the same thing, you know. And so that's really my comment. Yeah.
Chanel, thank you very much. I'm curious how, for you as a filmmaker, this massive movie fits into your body of work. I mentioned at the beginning, for people who don't know your work, you've done other sports documentaries like Magic and Bird, A Courtship of Rivals, The Curious Case of Curt Flood, and Brooklyn Dodgers' Ghost of Flatbush. Is there something that runs through, you know, the kinds of sports stories that you're interested in doing feature-length films about?
I mean, I certainly, in doing the films I've done, I've tried to figure out a way to use sports as a lens through which to talk about, you know, our culture and our society. Most of them have to do with race specifically, be it about certainly the, you know, Magic and Bird and that relationship. You know, Curt Flood, who was actually part of that to me, in line with those movements of athletes that I'm talking about, of the Bill Russells, the Arthur Ashes, the Kareem. He's a guy who in 1969 sort of called him, said, I don't want to be treated like a slave, when he was traded from the St. Louis Cardinals to the Philadelphia Phillies. And he took on Major League Baseball, you know, a sport that just 23 years earlier had not even integrated. And so, you know, for me, it's look at these, you know, sports can be a microcosm of our society. In looking at the issues in which, you know, these athletes and these owners and everything, this is a way to talk about our country and our world, and that's what we've tried to do. And with this film, that is just an extension of that. I frankly don't really look at this as a sports film. It's mm-hmm. about a football player, and mm-hmm. we talk about how great he is. But in some ways, the notable thing about OJ as an athlete is both his beauty as a football player, which you can then understand as a viewer. You can be, again, seduced by him and understand why we fell in love with him in the first place, and in turn that informs the notion that the idea of athletic worship in our culture, what it does, you know, why we sort of bow down to these people, why we allow them inside of us. And that very much was brought to bear in terms of why we, you know, race was one thing in terms of what had happened in this country, but similar to that is, oh, we were complicit in creating this hero, this star. And by the time he was on trial for murder, that just sort of spoke to the complicated feelings that we all had for OJ.
You've won an Emmy. What does it feel like to be nominated for an Oscar?
It's overwhelming, but it's nice.
You're going to be in the hall on Oscar night one way or another?
Is that I'm guessing I'm going to be in the hall at Oscar night.
Yes. That's great. And if the film wins, you're the one who goes up to accept it?
I am.
They don't make that big a deal about the feature-length documentary, not as much as I think they should. But go ahead.
No, but Brian, I was going to say, like, when you look at these films that are nominated, and the fact is you're saying, well, look, everyone talks about, you know, the sort of narrative features. But, I mean, I think that these films that are nominated, our film, I Am Not Your Negro, 13, Fire at Sea, Life Animated, these have been really impactful films
That's
in our
true.
Culture in 2016.
That's true.
And so in that way, I don't really look at us as the stepchild of you know, the Academy Award conversation. I mean, these are legitimate films talking about our society, and I think the fact that people have watched and absorbed them in the way they was gives credence to that.
I agree. And more than in any other year, I think, since we've been doing this series. So good that these documentaries are stepping out and being impactful, and very good that yours has. It's such a masterful work. Ezra Edelman has made O.J. Made in America. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Brian.